So as you know, Happiness is on right now at the Museum of Liverpool. It's an exhibition that is all about one of our city's greatest icons, Sir Ken Dodd. And I'm back today. I've been here before. I'm back today for a very special reason, because I've got Lady Anne Dodd with me. I've got Dickie Mint as well. But we're going to have a little chat, and we're going to get a little tour from yourself about some of your favourite exhibits and pieces within here. First of all, the biggest question for me is, what would Ken make of this exhibition?
I hope he'd be absolutely thrilled to bits with it. I'm sure he would be.
And obviously, you've been involved in putting this together and choosing some of these artefacts. You must have some favourites.
Well, as we go round, I will realise there are some that are more favourite than others. But when you ask about what would he think about it, he'd be very humbled to think they're making a whole exhibition of me. You know, to quote one of these lines from a show he would say to people, you know, this is an educational show. When you go out of here tonight, you'll say, well, that's taught me a lesson. So I hope people are going here and feel it's really taught them something about him.
We're going to have a chat about your life with Ken as well, which we'll talk about. Nothing too personal, so don't worry. Obviously, 40 years you were with Ken. 40 magical years, yes. I presume.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, I'd first met him another 15 years before that, because I was in a show with him and I worked with him, and so we'd kept in touch over that time. But it was actually 40 years I was really helping him and doing shows with him and everything, yeah.
Okay, well, listen, we're going to go inside and take a look at this incredible exhibition, which is on until March, by the way. Lady Anne, will you take me through?
I will indeed.
Let's do this.
Oh, we've got your ticket.
Yeah. So obviously we start here, Anne. What's it like when you see him again?
I think, of course, this is the iconic picture of Ken from the 60s. But when people say, which is the picture we should use, this is the one you'd always recognise him from. This. It's the hair, the eyes, the teeth and everything. So, of course, I'm seeing that all the time. It's on posters and booklets and everything. But coming in here, because I'm getting the feeling of what other people feel when they're coming in. I know it all, as it were, but I want to see it from the perspective of people who know him from the stage and know the outside, but not what goes on, how it all came together and how he became the sort of comedian he was, the person he was.
How do you think he became the person he was and the comedian that he was? How do you think he done it?
Well, he loved performing. He absolutely loved performing. And he was totally dedicated. He was single-minded. He knew from the start he wanted to go on the stage. He always said his parents took him to the theatre, the three of them, his brother and sisters and himself. When they were children, they were taken to what was called the Shakespeare Theatre of Varieties. And they used to see a variety show, and he would take them most weeks and they'd see different artists. And Ken had this lovely, warm, pink glow of a theatre, and the lights go down and the stage lights up and somebody comes on. And he always saw that the comedian was the engine driver, the most important part. He said, I want to be an engine driver. I want to be a comedian. How do I comedian, Dad? And his favourite comedian was his dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously, growing up in Liverpool as well, that must have helped. We'll keep walking on, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. Growing up in Liverpool, obviously a city filled with comedy, with laughter, and with so many other big characters, that must have shaped Ken for who he became.
Yes. He used to call them his godfathers, the famous comedians from the past, Ted Ray, Arthur Askey, why can't I name them all, but they are listed here. They were the people that he admired when he was a child and he grew up. And he called them the godfathers. He did a show in 2008, and half of it was based on the history of comedy in Liverpool and all the comedians that have come from Liverpool. And it is a city, a Merseyside, you know. And we've got one that, just behind us there, that one that asks everybody, why do you think the city's fun? And they're sort of literally vox pops in the street.
Yeah.
What do you think makes Liverpool funny?
He was a big supporter of other comedians as well. So there's a bit in this exhibition, which is just over there, which has got some of the younger comedians. Yes. So John Bishop, Paul Smith, Lily Savage, Paul O'Grady. And he really lent his knowledge to those guys, didn't he?
We've made a documentary that includes lots of interviews with people like that. In fact, one of the most recent ones was with Paul O'Grady, and he was influenced by him. He said a lot of them have said they were influenced by his style, by his enthusiasm, by his way he worked. And he always used to say, he used to love meeting young comedians that had been waiting at the stage door, you know, or whatever. Or if he met them in TV studios or wherever. But if they really were starting out, he'd love to encourage them and say, just if you want to be a comedian, get out there, do it. Get yourself, but be original. Try to be something special and different. Don't just copy anyone. And create it yourself if you can. The most important thing is you can create comedy. It's hard to do, but... yeah, be original, he used to say.
Yeah, what was it like when he was creating that comedy? So in your house in Knotty Ash, I'm sure he put many hours in terms of creating these gags and these moments and scenarios. When his head was in that zone, what was he like? Was he, well, was it difficult to live with him as he was working, or did he bring you in on it?
No, working-wise would be... his brain would be ticking all the time. And I think you've heard about the notebooks, which are a tiny example of them are on view here, because he used to say to me, you will burn all my notebooks, won't you? And he was a prolific writer of stuff. Some of it would be for ideas for script writers to work on, or for him to make sure. He used to say, always write something down if you get an idea, because it won't stay there, it'll go. So he'd work on his ideas and discuss things with the writers to develop an idea or scripts for television or whatever. He was always very enthusiastic, but he wasn't. The biggest workout is doing the show. You're working on stage. That creates it. That builds up. And the drummer used to stay on stage, musicians, even though normally they go off on the bit where they know there's a long bit of patter. But our drummer used to stay on stage and write down anything he's never heard before. That was the instruction from Ken, because that's an ad lib that's come out at that moment. And when he gets off stage, he can't remember those ad libs. So he will write down a quick note, and then Ken will look at those later and remind him what he did. And occasionally you wonder where it comes from. He said it comes from the back of the head, because you're motoring, and if it's a big audience and you're working, you know, it's feedback from them, and it comes out. With Dickie Mint, he'd do the little, if people don't know what Dickie Mint is, his lovely puppet Dickie Mint, he would talk to him, and Dickie Mint would say something he's never heard before, which is ridiculous, isn't it? But it's come from here.
Wow.
And he's put words in his mouth and he's laughing at his own... It's ridiculous. But it's so... Your brain is going so fast at that time. You're on adrenaline, you're pumping away. And he used to say, 6 TPM, 6 titters per minute. He tried to get in when you're motoring and going bang, bang, bang. Yeah.
He was very sharp. He was very fast, you know, in terms of that delivery. So he did think on the spot a lot as well. Yes. Obviously, he had his stuff he pre-planned, as you say.
Right.
But I remember interviewing him, and I was thinking, where is it coming from?
I know.
And it was new stuff. You could tell he was just... He was very of the moment, wasn't he?
He was. Yes, you're right. He was very creative. Hmm. And he had hundreds of books. He used to go to the libraries and get books out and read on comedy, laughter, humour, as though they're separate subjects almost, but, you know, and the workings of minds. And I remember one book, Creative Imagination, although we have so many books at home, this library book, I keep taking down, but Creative Imagination, making your mind be more creative and imagine things. So he'd look up all those sort of theories.
It's fascinating to hear this Lady Anne, and this must be stuff that you kind of take for granted because you live with him for so long. But let's have a little look around some of the exhibits. So I don't know, you guide us and show us.
I didn't know him when he used this very first doll. Okay. And as they say, they call him Charlie Brown, which is a bit silly because it's a bee and you're not supposed to have to say bees when you're a puppet. But these are very early pictures.
So this is a picture of Ken looking very young. And
in those days, he said he used to use a piece of cork, you burn the end of it and put it there and it makes it black.
Right.
It made him a bit older. I think you only see a bit of a trace of it there, because I think it rubs off when he's talking. But he said when he first went on, he used to make himself look older, because people didn't see young comedians really as being funny.
When did you meet him? What year did you meet Ken?
Well, I met him first in Christmas 61, 62. I was in his show at Manchester Opera House. And like you do in show business, you became friends. But I stayed in the business for a couple of years then came back. Then I was away working for an airline, and then I came back working in the 70s. But I didn't act anyway during those years, because once you've been on stage, you like
get the buzz.
It, yes.
So you met him in the 60s, and then you formed that relationship.
Yeah, I met his family and friends. You know, you sort of keep in a sort of, it's another world, showbiz.
Yeah.
A great world. And then, yes, late 70s, we sort of really got together. And then I left the airline I'd been working for in 1980 because I couldn't do both. So then from then on, I really worked with him. I did an act on stage in his shows, and the last 20 years, because of different agents that had passed away or whatever, I thought, well, I can carry on booking them rather than go to a new agent. And when they send you up to Glasgow one day and then down to the south coast the next day, I needed to know where it was convenient and it would be easiest. And this, it was set up, as it were. I didn't have to produce him. He produced himself. I just did the bookings with the theatres, and it was good fun, yeah.
So would you say you were his agent, his producer,
I did a bit of everything.
Yeah, a bit of everything.
I learned a bit from agents. We had agents to help us with television bookings and things like that. But with the theatres, it was easy to deal direct.
Obviously, Naughty Ash we need to talk about. We've still got lots to talk about, Lady Anne. Let's whiz through some of these exhibits. We've got the video which shows some of the newer comedians. We got some of Ken's flyers and posters from some. These were his stand-up shows, weren't they? So the Opera House and Blackpool. Tell us about some of these.
Well, although whenever he was asked what was your favourite theatre, he would say the one I'm playing tomorrow night, which is tactful, because what do you say? But the biggest shows he ever did so regularly, the Blackpool shows, 62. Well, it turned out the big ones were every 2 years in Blackpool at 62, 64, 66, 68. They haven't put all the programmes up, obviously. And he first started in Blackpool on the Central Pier, but there are other theatres. There are cinemas that were theatres as well, the Winter Gardens. He played just about every theatre in Blackpool, but the big ones were in the 60s and 70s, big shows, 16 weeks, twice nightly, the biggest theatre in Europe. Opera House Blackpool, he was king of that theatre.
So they were long runs for a comic to be on.
20 weeks in the summer seasons. And of course, we go further along, you see where he played Palladium. First time he played that was in 1965, where he did the longest run anybody's done as a single artist, not when it's a big musical shows, obviously those have gone for years. But it tells the record for that longest season done by a single artist in his show.
How did he get through those long runs, and how did you get through them? Because that must have been tough.
Well, those were before I worked with him. Those were long seasons. But you get used to doing long seasons. Even in the 80s, we were doing some longer seasons, like pantomimes could be 10, 12 weeks and things. But they're great fun. They're great fun, and you become a family with the people you work with. And if you're easygoing, you get on with everybody. It's fun if you haven't got any egos coming up somewhere along the lane, but it works. Show business is quite levelling with people, you know. They like to, it's more fun if it all works and you get on together. This is one of my favourite ones. So it's amazing.
This is a giggle map,
and it actually shows all the theatres he played. I don't know why some are in black, some are in white, but it shows up and it names the theatres in that place. And we played, actually, you should have it up here, because we're up in the Shetland, or in Shetland. There we are. Wow. There's Inverness, and the Shetland should be up here. There we are.
Wow.
Is that it?
There it is, yeah. The Shetland. So this is a map, an interactive map.
Yeah. Because
and
the amazing thing...
touch like what you want to see, and
that's
you're hitting the Shetlands.
That's called the court...
Garrison Theatre.
Garrison Theatre, that's right. We should have left my glasses on, sorry. The Garrison, yeah. I never realised it was so far out.
So we play it very
it's
far, yeah.
To Norway, is it?
It is, yeah. So Norway's got to be...
Good gracious.
There?
Good gracious. I've never looked at it as being that far. Yes, we went there. We flew to Aberdeen, and then we had a small flight to there.
Do you remember every gig?
Yes.
Do you?
I can now picture that theatre. In fact, I remember what happened. He went on. It was just the two of us and the two musicians, just a small show, and we were going to do a couple of shows, first and second house. And he went on. And They did speak differently. It's the same language, but it's and he spoke so quickly, and the laughs weren't coming, so we went quicker and quicker. And I'm at the side going, slow down, because I realised what was happening. But he must have felt awful because the laughs weren't coming.
Mm.
And then he realised, I've really got to slow down. So he did. And he said, she's signalling to me. They're all going, he said, I think she wants me to slow down. Is that right? And they're all going, yeah.
He never ever lost his Scouse accent either, did he?
He didn't really. He always said he was a Liverpudlian. He never really had a very strong accent. But he felt what he did feel, much as it's nice to keep your area dialect or your area intonation, you have to. He felt then, because in those days they didn't accept regional things around the country so much. He went south, oh, from the, you know. So, but he knew he had to make sure I could be heard and understand throughout the country, even if it was a bit difficult up in Lerwick.
Even if it was in Lerwick, which is closer to Norway than the UK.
But he did have also for singing, he had voice production lessons and right. breathing lessons, and there was a touch of speech and clarity.
Did Ken, and I'm not saying this in a negative way, because I think to get on stage and do what he did, you need some level of ego.
Yeah.
Did he have an ego?
He would admit himself you have to have an ego to go on stage, absolutely. Also, if you're top of the bill, there's always somebody waiting to come up, and you know you've got to get, if you get there, you've got to stay there. And he first hit top of the bill in one of these shows in the late 50s, and I'm proud to say he never hit anything less than top of a bill in all his theatre shows, because that's the sad thing when people go down the bill, you know. But you do have to have, you've got to have an ego, yeah, to go on at all. Mm. But he had nerves like anyone else. Not when it's every night you're doing the same, not virtually the same thing. He always says, I never did the same show twice, because he'll change around a bit. But, but before big television shows, before royal shows, you're terrified. Yeah. Because you've no other chance. It's now. You don't go back and do it. They edit it for the programme, but they're up there, and this is there, and the audience are there, and the audience is rather harder to royal show, because they're all, the ones at the front are all the agents, and they want their artists to do well, so they don't like the other ones. You know, it's a bit harsh, that bit. It's a very hard show to do.
Yeah, and it's a hard, showbiz is a hard world.
It is a hard world, yes, it is a hard world. You've got to have tough, you've got to have, one critic once wrote, you've got to have a bit of ice there to cope with it, because there are things and forces that'll knock you down, you know. And as I say, if you get up there, you've got to stay up.
Got to stay. It's a great, great, great line.
Yeah.
What was it that made him kind of so likeable? Because everybody, whether you knew him or you didn't know him, whether you were a fan or an audience member or a colleague, everyone seemed to love him. Everyone seemed to like Ken.
I find it hard to be objective on that, but I've had, after he died, all these wonderful letters and cards that came. I think it was that he had time for everybody. People would come up into the street and talk to him and everything. And that's what comes to me now. I do little talks to groups, women's institutes and whatever, church groups. And always half a dozen of them come up and say, I remember when I met him. Oh, and they've got stories about when they met him. And they've never forgotten it. And it'll be a simple little story. He just wrote this for me and he said this. And I think, and it became personal. But I've watched him with people. He always looked straight at them. He didn't look over the shoulder. What else is going on? Am I missing anything?
Yeah.
Like a lot of people do. He did have time for people, and he had great empathy for them. You know, people would tell them their life stories, and I'd be sitting in the car waiting to drive home, and I love it all. He's enjoying himself, and he'd be tired. It'd be after a show, but somebody else said they've lost somebody, or they didn't want to come out to a show again, but they were made to. Family, somebody died, but you've made me want to live again, and that was such a common theme. And when anybody said to him, you see, I've lost my husband, I've lost my father and my mother or whatever, he'd turn around and he'd put the hand on the shoulder and say, you haven't lost them, they're still with you. They're here. And he would say that and mean it.
Yeah.
I mean it.
So we've just bumped into a visitor at the Museum of Liverpool. What's your name, sorry?
Maurice Tickle.
Maurice Tickle, that's yeah. a perfectly apt name for Ken's exhibition.
The story, yeah. Now, on Pilch Lane, which is part of Notty Ash, there's a chemist there. And I was in there one day, and I was just saying to Anne about it, and I said, I went in with a prescription. So I put the prescription in, and I thought, I'm standing there, and who walks in the door? Ken does. And guess what he's buying? He's buying a comb, right? Yeah. So he asks for a comb from behind the counter, and as he's getting it, I'm thinking nothing about it. And then the girl comes and said, prescription for tickle. And I turned around, and I said, not one word, he said. I'm not saying a word about it. Not a word. And I went and shook his hand and away. Yeah.
You mentioned some of the TV shows before and that. Some of these were big national TV shows.
Yeah, well, the big ones in the 60s.
And obviously they were live, weren't they?
Yeah.
He sometimes did an audience with. And
he did
that
two
was,
audience with.
Yeah.
Which is not unusual in itself. Yeah, the first was in 92-3 and the second was in 2000 or something. And I'm so glad those were made, because at the time we'd had all the alternatives and different people coming in. There's room for everybody. He never said there wasn't, but it was a different form of comedy. But he used to refresh his comedy. He knew I can't just stay behind doing the old mother-in-law jokes or the whatever jokes. And I'm glad those were made, because they are actually timepieces of show and of him. As it full throttle, I use the expression, somebody who's done a review once, at full throttle.
It's funny because you mentioned Paul O'Grady. I was watching one of his audience with shows, and they are kind of time stamps,
yes,
to just that moment in time. Yeah. And the celebrities in the audience, yes, a lot aren't with us anymore, and you go, oh God, there's Barbara Windsor, there's, and it's well, but it is history, isn't it?
So sad, there are so many there that are no longer with us, including in the top, that they're the celebrities. And the top part, I've got my younger brother and sister who died far too young, and they're both there in that. So to me, it's very much a memory. They
must
were there.
Be nice to watch.
Yeah.
Was he showbiz? You know, did he like a bottle of champagne?
No, he wasn't flash at all. He wasn't flash at all. He enjoyed lovely things happening. To him, people say, to him, money was a measure of success. But he was happy to live the way he'd lived, the way he'd been brought up. He didn't really spend much on himself. He had a lovely car. And we did well. We did well. He could have a nice house and do things for the house. And I used to have his car to do what I wanted with. You know, I could do anything. But he wasn't flash, and I wasn't either. He suited us. It's the way we lived.
So we're in front of. So this is the Ha Ha, and this Ken produced a one-man three-hour show at the Playhouse in April '73. A three-hour show. We're going to talk about the duration of his shows in a second. So tell us about this, Anne.
This show was his baby. He wanted to do a show about the story of humour, the history of humour, you know, starting with the Commedia dell'arte and all the rest of it. And then when he was planning it and doing little tryouts, he found there aren't many laughs in it if I just tell it as a story. So I've got to make it, it's got to be funny and entertaining. So he really worked at it. And it was just a one-man show at the Playhouse Theatre in, well, I can't remember the exact year, mid the 70s, wasn't it? I
think it's 1973, yeah.
He played Malvolio in Twelfth Night there for a short season at the Playhouse, and he really learned it word for word. We'll probably come to that. But he went back to the Playhouse to do this, to his creative thing, and they're all the props that you'd have, the red hot poker, the slapstick, that's a slapstick, which is two pieces of wood that slap together, and the balloon thing there is called the pig's bladder. They used to blow it up and hit people over the head. It was a fool's license, you know, from the 60s, and that's, oh gosh, the word of it, of course, that's a tickling stick, a modelling, yeah. But his jesters, foil, it's the clown you use,
that's
and,
right.
And there again. But this particular show, you know, the wonderful theatre critic, arts critic, Michael Billington, when he was asked after 50 years in the business in writing for The Guardian, 50 years reviews of shows he'd seen over his life, could he mention, do an article on his 10 favourite evenings in a theatre? And the first one, whether it was number one or number 10, doesn't matter. But amongst those 10, but it happened to be the first he said, was Ken Dodd and Ha-Hon.
Wow.
Playhouse. And all the others were Laurence Olivier and this one and that. But to think that is rather, and I'm so proud of that.
So he was on that level, wasn't he? Yeah. He was really acclaimed in that respect.
It was wonderful. That was a comment he made after he'd passed away. But before that, they did, for his 90th birthday, he wanted to interview Ken for his 90th birthday. And in that article, which I hope Ken did see, I'm sure he will have done, Michael wrote, he's seen two people who could hold a stage, hold an audience and walk a stage, and had this great gift, Sir Laurence Olivier and Sir Ken Dodd.
Wow. The duration of his shows, let's talk about that, because that was, he became infamous with this, didn't he? He was prolific in terms of how long he was on stage, and audience members used to come out saying, we've had our breakfast, lunch and tea while we've been in watching Ken. What was it like for you? Did you ever stand side of stage and think, hurry up, I want to get the tea on, hurry
occasionally,
up.
If we'd got a contract that said you must finish by a certain amount, and really have to, because either the alarms come on or something like that, or going to be massive overtime and there's too many taxes and all that. He's not stupid, but he did go over sometimes, and if you go over a few minutes, you're into the next hour. So he said, well, I might as well stay on. But he could, and I'd give him the list of messages. And he never did them at the beginning, unless it was pantomime, you had to do them early on. But he'd do what we call the party list. And I'd condense it so it wasn't for too long. But you've got to do them. People have written and asked you to say something. And I keep, and right at the bottom I put, overtime. Or you've got 5 minutes because we've got to really be off by a certain time. But he ended up in the last years, he used to say, there's a rumour I do long shows. I don't do long shows. I give value for money.
That's right. Well, that's exactly what he did. Just on his props, they were so important to him, weren't they?
What
was that like? Was your house filled with all sorts of props and pieces he'd used?
He always used it, tickling sticks. He said he first ever used something as a prop to wave, because he felt him waving around. It was something to hold. Because when you are performing, you do have to control your hands a bit. If you're an actor, you're taught how to do that. But it was natural to move. So that's how it happened to get a thing he ended up calling a tickling stick. He used to have little feather ones. But, you run out of feathers to make them. This firm used to make them, and they only had so many.
Yeah.
And he was giving them away from the stage. In the end, people said, well, why don't you sell them, do them with merchandise with you? Did him anything? So we never, ever sold the feather ones, but started doing the sheepskin ones.
Right.
And they were nice souvenirs that people could have. You know, it was just, as long as you cover the costs and,
yeah, absolutely,
and everything.
So we've got some more. So this is when, well, obviously he was honoured, wasn't he, by Liverpool Jumbos.
Right. And you know, when they did it, have you seen this? They made a costume for Dickie Mint, you see.
You got a little costume for Dickie Mint as well.
And he didn't know till it was the day. And he said, what's that? I said, it's Dickie Mint's costume.
Tell us about these Get Well Soon cards.
Well, I think those must have been when he was at his last illness week. And they got hundreds of them. People are so lovely. Yeah. We had a whole one from a whole school. All the little drawings of the faces and the Get Well Soon little labels. And yeah.
That's because people really cared for him.
And that was the Freedom of the City, which he was very, very...
Freedom of Liverpool, yeah.
City. And that's it photographed. I've never seen it less down.
Wow. And he deserved that,
well,
didn't he?
He was very honoured, very thrilled.
Obviously, you mentioned you get lots of mail and get well soon wishes and stuff. That's because everybody knew where you lived. Including me as a child. We used to drive, because I'm from West Derby, and we'd go past, and every time when you're young, your dad says, that's where Ken Dodd lives.
Yeah.
And then me mates, as we got older, be, there's Doddy's house, and you'd sometimes see him, you'd sometimes look out to see if you could see him. Yeah. He made that his home, and you made that your home for so, so long. It was really important that you stayed there, wasn't it?
Well, yes, I mean, it was always to come back for, obviously, when they say who he came back from everywhere, of course he did seasons and he stayed away, but even when he did the Playdom, he used to come back once a week, make sure he got back or whatever. And whatever season you're doing around the country. But he loved Nottingham, he loved the area, you know. And we've done the hall, done up the church hall, because that was in, it was the school he went to. And it suddenly, when a hole developed in the floor, so we couldn't, it was still being used, but then we couldn't use it anymore. I've done it at his foundation, we did it up, and we extended it and everything. I'm glad we've done that in the last few years. He hadn't done it. We didn't know about it, but it's his money that's paid for it. So really thrilled with that. And we did up the church clock and the, they took it apart and everything. So, yeah.
What was he like at home, Ad? So, you know, whether you were, say he had a few weeks off, what would Ken be like in the house? Would he cook? Would he watch TV? Would he
watch TV, TV. He'd watch other comics. He'd watch comedy shows. He'd watch Fraser, Dad's Army, Thin Blue Line, a lot of difference. Ben Elton ones, what are they?
Blackadder.
Yeah, like Blackadder. It's very creative, you know. He loved a lot of television. Really quite broad. He'd watch everything. Doesn't mean to say you absolutely like everything or the muck or whatever. But he would watch it. You've got to keep your mind going. And he liked watching racing.
Okay.
And he liked watching Flogget and things like that. So he was like most people, I suppose, but he was a late riser. But he didn't cook at all, but he made the best cup of tea in the business. Yeah. Absolutely, did he make two. But we never had more than, it would never be, I think 4 weeks was the most ever going without doing a show. And if we ever went on holiday, it would be 10 days maximum, really, because it's leaving a dog with someone who's kind enough to look after him. We didn't put him in kennels, and there was always a dog to be looked after.
Christmas, he loved Christmas because he used to do them famous shows. I interviewed him at the Philharmonic. He did seem to really enjoy the festive period, didn't he? What was Christmas like?
He loved Christmas because it was you could put all sorts of things on. It was he did like we didn't have children, sadly, but we he had the Diddy Man in the shows. And he liked a big show, and you'd always put magic acts on, because kids like them, adults like them if they're skilled. It was always fun, and you're at home. And then Christmas Day, we used to go to church quite regularly. The cathedral was quite a regular thing because we could go to a choral evensong at 3:30 in the afternoon on a Sunday, so it's a good time. And the local church, St John's, we'd be there.
Was he? Did he make you laugh at home, or had you heard it all? Were you laughing a lot? I can imagine you were.
We shared. My sense of humour. Obviously, I suppose we shared a sense of humour, or I developed a sense of humour watching him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We did quite like my cooking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was his favourite dish?
He loved my pea soup.
Oh, pea soup, nice.
Pea soup, homemade pea soup. Oh, God.
And there you are, you're on screen. So this is talking about the Ken Dodd Charitable Foundation. So this is what I wanted to mention with you, because what you realise when you come to this exhibition is just how much Ken gave back. We mentioned about younger comedians, but to the local community, to charities. Yeah. He really did give a lot of time and money and effort, didn't he?
It's time you give, isn't it? Because I used to say, he's going to do a charity show somewhere or whatever, and it was a distance and everything. I'd say, you're not very well. You could really just make a donation equal to what they'd make, and then you wouldn't feel you're letting them down. He said, no, that's not the way to do it. I've said, I'm going to do it. And he would do them. And if he had a commitment to do a show, no matter if it was a paid show or not, he would do it. And they used to say to anyone else who cried off, if you're in this business, that's what you do. But he did. He couldn't say no. It was a nice fund. It was nice. It was easy to say yes.
When I was a kid, I put a book together for a charity. I was about 12, and I wrote to as many celebrities as I could to get them to write and send a signed photograph that we could put in the book and auction off.
Yes.
And we got everyone. We got Princess Di wrote a letter and everything.
That's lovely.
So we got everyone. But the only one that done me a version was Sir Ken Dodd.
Oh, really?
So he done the copy for the book, and then he done one for Young Jay, which I've still got at home.
Oh,
so
gosh.
So when I got that, I was like, wow, he's wrote one for me as well. So he cared about people, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He did. He thought how they would feel. Yeah, that's very true.
The Charitable Trust, tell us about that. Is that still the foundation? Is that still running?
He always had a sort of charitable thing we had before he died, but he set up the foundation a few years before he died.
Well, we'll keep walking and we'll see what else we've got to see. So this is the British Legion.
That's actually membership things, but this was his Good Turns Society, which he started.
Right. Actually, so I'm looking here, there's charities like Macmillan, Alder Hey.
The local comedians who he knew when he was young and growing up, not the well-known ones, but one or two of them became more well-known, but they were more the club comics he worked in where he learned his trade. And when one of them died, he'd always go, has he gone? Oh, what a shame. Let me know when the funeral is. And he would always go to the funerals. And he'd meet them all at the thing. And he said, they used to meet together. And then it's like, hey, Doddy, have you heard this one? And they'd be behind gravestones. Doddy, have you heard this one? And they're all coming out. He said, this is good. This is a funeral. He said, so with a fellow called Phil Kernott, who was a lovely, lovely man, he and Ken, I remember them in the kitchen. They were saying, what should we do? Let's have a get together. And Ken said, well, you get a name of all the ones you can. So they got about 30, 40 names. He said, I'll invite them. I'll take them to lunch. Book a thing and I'll book a lunch and we'll have that. And from that, then Ernie Mack, who was a club fellow you've probably heard of, Ernie Mack was there and he said, oh, I'll do the next one. And then they said, well, do you want to keep it going? People just need to pay for their lunch and we'll all get together. And then Ken started putting acts on as part of the thing. And it became a regular thing. So they'd have typical men. Christmas, we could all have one. And the rest of the year, it was just men only. But that was one of the ones where the men were together.
This is Jimmy Tarbuck and Tom Connor.
The whole point was, it was like, it was called the Good Turns because they were made up of people who were turns.
Yeah,
you know,
were
turns, acts. Yeah, right, that's it. And do a good turn. It wasn't a specific charity. It was never a specific charity. It was something, they'd have a raffle and raise money and that might pay for the acts they're putting on, because he said, no, if acts come on, they're paid. I don't expect them to get the time. And then we still run it now and we do raise money and then, but it helps pay artists who might not be getting work or whatever.
That's something else you'll learn when you come here. There's so much. Now, we've got a nod to Ken's music career as we turn this corner.
Yes.
Which, obviously, comedy was so big, but early on, his music career was pretty big. He had some big hits, one of them obviously being Happiness.
And Tears. And Tears was the one that was in the hit parade for about X number of weeks. And Paul Gambaccini used to quote the statistic on it. It was the third biggest selling record of the 60s. It was only second to the Beatles.
Wow.
Number one and two and three. He was number three. And of course, he always loved recording. He loved singing. He used to say to young comedians, well, why don't you finish on a song? But they'd say, I can't sing. He said, well, I don't think I could particularly, but he did. He always loved singing. Yeah, he could sing, and he had his voice trained, so he did.
So would Ken listen to music at home? Did he like other musicians?
Yes, we go to concerts and things. We used to go to Berlin every Christmas the last few years. Even before the wall came down, we'd been, because he liked the shows, and we go to a serious one, maybe an opera or a concert, and then go to a massive variety show of dancers and everything. But it was very international. There was hardly any comedy. So it needs a bit of comedy in there.
Yeah.
And then there was one called the Wintergarten, which is Wintergarten, and it's really a variety, but very classy. You know, really classy acts, might be silent or mime, but very, very polished. You tend to say variety is dead, and it isn't. There are these acts all around the world that you watch and think, oh, that's clever.
Yeah. He seemed like a man that would enjoy music and other musicians performing.
He also says about the variety acts, it's a variety of skills. It'll never die because there are people who, kids who grow up and want to do things. I've got two children at the moment. I've been helping, doing a bit of sponsorship with them, and both of them now are at Chetham's, the music school. They both got scholarships, not because I've done anything, but I was asked to help them find an interim teacher, which I did. And the little boy started this week. He's 8, and he is just incredible. And his sister is 10. Actually, was 10 this week as well. Her birthday the same week. And they are just incredible, and they've both got scholarships at Chetham's, and that's so exciting. I mean, that is a school.
Congratulations. Right. We're going to go to your cabinet. So this is your little bit of the exhibition.
Yeah, that was the show I was first in with him, and that's my guitar, and that was one of the stewardess.
So that says British Airways, and it says Miss A. Jones. So that was your badge. So you were cabin crew?
No, I was, but that should be further forward, because that bit was when I left cabin crew and I went into cabin management.
Right.
And then I went into personnel and I became senior personnel officer, North. No training. I hadn't been to university. I didn't have Institute of Personnel Management. But I had one thing, a bit of common sense.
Bit of common sense, which is sometimes all you need, Lydia.
I loved it. I loved it. Because it was with people. And I'd been a stewardess for 12 years.
Yeah. It says here, the partner, determined and capable, and played a vital role in Ken's career. In later years, she arranged the bookings, dealing with practicalities of being on the road. She even joined him on stage in comedy routines.
Yeah, so would you did an act.
Would you look back and say that's...
He hasn't got it there. Picture somewhere of me with the crazy...
Would you look back? That vital role line, I think, is key.
That's
right. would Ken have said that? You're vital to him.
I think so. Yeah. I think he'd admitted it. Just about. He did. I said once, oh, I can't do it. I said, well, I can't manage without you. I said, I think I might disappear if we had a bit of a few words you have. I'll go. Didn't have words, but occasionally, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody does.
Of course.
Well, I can't manage it. I can't do the shows without you. No.
It seems a lot of comedians in the past, and I'm thinking of Tommy Cooper, and, you know, they turn to drink and stuff off stage. Ken didn't, did he?
I don't think it's they turn to drink. It's very easy to enjoy a drink and enjoy maybe a little more than a drink. And it's sad. I don't think there's that many cases where they turn to drink and it makes them alcoholic, and it's dreadful. That is a shame. They can't resist it, you know. Ken loved his lager, loved lager, and he loved a brandy and thingy, but I remember him saying, I'm getting a bit fond of the brandy. Never had that when he was working. What he had when he was working was might have a pint at the interval, even just a half at the interval, half a lager. And then he'd have two or three at the end because he's bad at it. But he was, it is sad. There are stories when it's taken too much. He said, I think the thing that would worry him about getting alcoholic, he saw it in the business. And he saw people who did. He saw one particular comedian. People wouldn't know him now, but he was an older one when Ken was starting up. And his wife once said to Ken, I've had three houses sold under me because he couldn't give up. He was a gambler. Gambled all the money away, this man. And he was a very clever man. And his son and his grandson went into the business as well. But that put him off gambling, you know, if somebody says that to you. His wife said, you're in a terrible mess, you know.
Did Ken have any vices?
Sorry?
Did he have any vices?
I don't think so.
No?
How did it? No.
I presume the buzz was just being on stage. We're gonna finish things soon. A couple more bits to talk about. We've got all his Ken's notebooks on display, which you can come and see. Before we finish, Lady Anne, have you got one piece, one exhibit in here that you want to talk about, that you'd like to see? There's Dickie Mint. So we've got Dickie Mint, we've got the big drum.
He was his favourite.
Dickie Mint was his favourite.
Oh, absolutely. It was his prop. Well, Dickie Mint, he was a lot bigger than that because his ears were longer. You know, his throat was longer. He'd push him up for him and talk, made to talk in the mouth. The eyes and the mouth operated. But when we travelled, I would think the most precious thing in this exhibition, because they have to insure everything, I said, he's priceless. You can't put a fear on that. When we were doing shows and everything, he was in a case, special case, with other bits and bobs that protected, you know, and had to. And if we were night stopping somewhere, a hotel or whatever, he'd say, bring the case in with him. Anything else you can replace. He had to come in the hotel with us. And occasionally the case would be packed right in the middle of everything because somebody'd help me. And I'd say, do I need to? And I must admit, he'd say, well, all right then. And I'd be worried all night. You know, nobody breaks in the car or steals it. He was stolen once and it was in the paper. He was diddy napped, the papers put. Echo put, diddy napped. And the Mirror picked up this story, and they said, "If you, they were offering a reward, and because Ken offered a reward, and they said, oh, we'll double it, we'll do the thing,' and it did turn up miraculously, and they think they paid the person who did it.
Right, so they
you know God. So in the end, the Mirror said, 'No, we'll do that.' It made a nice story for us and everything, but we were so glad to get him back, you know."
I read somewhere once that you said, I know you mentioned you never had children, but you said the Diddy Man and Dickie Mint were like having children.
Well, it was his... People used to say when he sang the song, climb up on my knee, little boy, da 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 da, little boy, and then... My son. And he used to sing songs that were sentimental to do with it all. And he would sing them very well. And people would say, I was crying when I watched that. Yeah.
What would you say to anyone that's thinking of coming to check out this exhibition? What would you say to them? Because people really do need to come to the Museum of Liverpool, don't they?
Yes.
We've only got till March. It's only until March, which is going to fly by.
Well, it will. You're right. It's already 4 weeks since it opened. And yeah, people mustn't think it goes on forever. I hope it'll actually stir a younger generation. Because he entertained children. And in fact, there was Stephen Shakeshaft was a photographer, and quite a lot of the photographs are nearby Stephen Shakeshaft. And Stephen had an exhibition of his own of Ken's pictures here a few years ago, and Ken came here to open it with him. And that day there was a group of children, only small children, it is 10, 15 years ago, whatever. These small children, they wouldn't have seen him on stage, but they watched him and listened. In the end, they're all cheering and everything because he did have this charismatic way, you know, with him and could communicate. So I think it'd be a shame to lose that. So I think this perpetuates him.
How do you want him to be remembered? I think we've all got our own ways that we think Ken will be remembered. For me, it's happy, it's smiling, it's funny, it's caring. How would you want Ken to be remembered?
I mean, he was asked once, what would you expect to have an epitaph? He said, happiness and laughter. He brought happiness and laughter. I think he was... an amazing person. I can't describe him really. I'd like them to remember him as a great comedian, a lovely singer, but a wonderful entertainer who loved his audiences. And you could see when he performed, his audiences loved him. And he spread love and happiness. And he got it back from people. And the letters and things I've had from people since he passed away are incredible. And I do little talks from time to time. And when I do, there are always several people say, I remember when I met him. And then tell me a little story. We've just met one in here today. A wonderful human being.
What would you say to Ken now? If you could say anything, what would it be? Because we'll finish with this. What would you like to say to your long-term partner, to the man you looked after for so many years, who you made lovely pea soup for? And what would you say to Ken?
I miss you.
Okay. Lady Anne Dodd, thank you so much for chatting to us.
Thank you.
The exhibition is on right now. It's called Happiness, and it really is happy. It's jolly. It's feel good. And you will come out of it feeling just uplifted. And you'll learn so much as well about this remarkable man, this remarkable entertainer and icon of our city. So come and check it out, the Museum of Liverpool, right now. Lady Anne, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.